From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the crisis grows for Michigan football.
I mean, we would never, ever, if we thought a guy had a concussion, keep him in the game, and never have.
But now we hear, yes, Shane Morris did suffer a concussion. Now what? Plus, the Ford Mustang, still hot at age 50.
Young, vivacious, wanting to get out and go and do things. And I think that's why this car has lasted so long.
And fall reading picks from poet and writer Keith Taylor.
These stories are connected with this sort of general idea of weird things happen at the most common moments.
And we find out how GM and Ford are pushing anew to win over luxury buyers. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Years ago, Ford gave America the Mustang, and America has loved it ever since.
Young, vivacious, wanting to get out and go and do things. And I think that's why this car has lasted so long.
I'm Cynthia Canty. We look at the Mustang's past and its future today on Stateside. Then poet and writer Keith Taylor is here with his picks for our fall reading list. But first, to college football. It's a sports story out of Ann Arbor that's making headlines around the world. Wolverine quarterback Shane Morris taking a fierce blow to his head from a helmet last Saturday, wobbling off the field, only to be sent back in. That decision ignited a firestorm of controversy. Afterward, Coach Brady Hoke stood firm.
I mean, we would never, ever, if we thought a guy had a concussion, keep him in the game, and never have.
Ah, but then Michigan Athletic Director Dave Brandon releases a 15-paragraph statement at 1 this morning saying, yeah, Morris did suffer a concussion and a high ankle sprain. We have with us now Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. So Coach Hoke goes into this news conference on Monday. No one's there with him, and no one had told him that Shane Morris had suffered a concussion, but they did know it.
Yes, make that jibe, by the way. Take some linguistic gymnastics, to say the least. Either Brandon and Hoke did not discuss this at all, since it happened on Saturday and was already flaming that night on TV and elsewhere, and Sunday, when apparently they already determined he did in fact have a probable mild concussion. I can only imagine the discussions that the doctors had to push back to make that happen.
Yeah.
Then, of course, on Monday at noon, he gets up there and says all this stuff, Hoke does, that there was no concussion, we've not talked. So either they have no idea what the other guy is doing, there's no communication, a negligible level of non-communication, or somebody's lying. So I wouldn't call this a scandal quite. Whenever you ever have a crisis, if you will, it always boils down to either the guy's incompetent or he is corrupt. And they always pick incompetent, by the way. And this time they're picking incompetent.
Do you believe Brady Hoke when he said he would not knowingly play a kid with a concussion? Do you believe him?
Well, first of all, he did. That's
but
one
knowingly.
Thing.
But do you think he truly didn't
I don't think
know?
He would knowingly. I don't. I give him that. And I think that, furthermore, he would not have the option, because if the doctors knew that he had a concussion, they would not let him do so. And it must be said, I was on the sidelines for 3 years, 08, 09, 2010, 37 games. Rich Rodriguez was the head coach, not Brady Hoke. But the medical staff was the same, and they've added Jeff Kuchar to it, who is a worldwide expert in brain injuries, what we call concussions, and his research is cutting edge. He's on the staff now. I never once saw any discussions between coaches and doctors about any negotiating, about getting the kid back in or not, only can he go or can he not. And that includes Denard Robinson, second quarter of the game against Illinois in 2010, when a game that Rich Rod had to win to keep his job, he had a concussion, he was out, and that was it. No discussion. So that's the background. However, the communication breakdown here is so severe as to raise national questions.
And the fact that Dave Brandon, who is not camera shy, not microphone shy, releases this thing at 1 in the morning and nobody's seen him.
He was in the witness protection program, it looks like, for 3 days. This is very unusual for a man whose nickname is the Human Moth for his ability to find TV lights anywhere. So that was striking, and he's been absent since as well. So he's not been in front of any cameras, any microphones. It's back to the bunker mentality.
And really, now what?
Now what? The only question is really when. I think that both Brady Hoke and Dave Brandon are likely gone before too long. It might take a while, perhaps longer than Michigan fans would like. But I cannot imagine a scenario where these guys keep their jobs. I really can't. And it's not just this situation over the weekend. This is the final straw. This bonfire has been building over a 3-year period. four-year period with both Brannon and Hoke. It should be noted there's now a petition out there that Michigan alumni, faculty, and students can sign that's already gotten over 2,500 signatures to get Dave Brannon, not Brady Hoke, but Dave Brannon fired. There's a rally today at 6 p.m. on the Diag, organized by the students, to get Dave Brannon, again, not Brady Hoke, fired. I have never seen, Cindy, ever in my life, a situation where the AD was more unpopular than the coach.
One final question. Do we know how Shane Morris is doing?
He apparently is doing fine, and he could play this weekend if he wanted to.
Okay. Well, situation that is evolving. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon. Thanks, John.
Cindy, thank you.
These are challenging times for the executives who run the luxury brands at GM and Ford. Lincoln's been on wobbly legs for years, and Cadillac is lagging behind the competition, especially the German luxury competition. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here now. And Daniel, in your column today, you used the phrase Detroit's luxury pretensions. What do you mean by that word, pretensions?
Well, I mean, I've been following this story going back to, I would say, the Frankfurt Motor Show 1997, where I was at the unveiling of the Cadillac CTS to near silence in Germany when they said that this was going to be a credible player in Europe, and it turned out to be no such thing. These companies have been trying to get luxury buyers, primarily Audi, Mercedes, BMW buyers, to take their products seriously. And they've largely failed. Lincoln particularly has failed for a very, very long time, in large part because Ford Motor Company was not willing to spend the money and make the commitment to make Lincoln and to differentiate it enough from Ford. General Motors has done more with Cadillac, and I think a lot of people would tell you today that Cadillac has got the best product that Cadillac has been making in the modern era. The problem is the sales are not producing, and as a result, they are flailing around trying to figure out how they can match the promise of those vehicles with reality.
And now we're hearing talk of recommitment to the luxury brands. And let's start with Lincoln. We're hearing new CEO Mark Field say that we're in the very early stages of our transformation. Why did you find that statement ironic?
Because in 1999, they announced that they were going to move Lincoln and what was then Mercury division to Southern California to get it closer to the coastal customers that they wanted to sell to, because they were largely Midwestern brands. I mean, if you live in and work in Metro Detroit, you see a lot of Lincolns and Cadillacs are on the roads, because a lot of these people are being driven by employees or sons of and daughters of employees or grandchildren or whatever the case may be. You go out to Summit, New Jersey or Southern California, it's going to be a totally different thing. And they've been messing around with this stuff for a very long time, but they have a very long record of overpromising and underdelivering. And I think the question we have to ask now is, how is this going to be different, if at all? And I do think that the management of both of those companies is a lot more realistic than their predecessors about where they are. But there's no question but what this takes a very long time. And I'm not talking about a couple of years or one product cycle. I'm talking about multiple product cycles and a constant case of refinement. I talked with a German auto executive who headed Aston Martin for about more than a decade. And he at one time was an engineer on the Porsche 911 program. And he told me at the time, he said, the 911 today is not a credit to those of the guys that are doing that vehicle today. It's the guys who did it 10 and 15 years ago.
Hmm. By the way, speaking of moving, Cadillac made headlines announcing it's moving its headquarters to New York. And some are saying it's because its new chief wants to live in New York. GM says, no, 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 we were planning this anyway. We're moving to New York. What did you think of this idea and what message does this send?
Well, I think it's kind of cynical. At the end of the day, when a customer goes into the showroom, do they really care where the management of the brand lives and works? I would submit to you the answer is no. I also would suggest to you that there's probably at least a bit of truth in the fact that the new head of Cadillac, Johann Denischen, who headed Audi of America for a long time and was more recently at Infiniti based in Hong Kong, probably does want to not be in the Metro Detroit area. He also was at Audi at the time that Audi of America decamped from Auburn Hills and moved to suburban Washington, D.C. Again, because the whole argument was they could somehow be a hipper brand, they would be connecting with their customer base. Well, anybody who knows anything about Volkswagen in recent years knows that that brand has really been struggling in the United States. and it has made some probable mistakes on product that hasn't done as well as they had hoped, and they're retooling. Audi has been more successful, but I'm not at all convinced, and I don't see any evidence that moving headquarters around changes how customers on the coast or between the coasts regard the brand.
And in our last minute, I noticed you've totally pounced in your column today on the fact that Ford conspicuously seems to have thrown in the towel when it comes to selling its Lincolns in Europe, focusing on U.S. and China. What does this say to you?
Yeah, I was really they did an investor conference yesterday and made a good argument about the growth in luxury. I mean, essentially, they make the argument you've got to be in luxury in some way, shape, or form because it's going to continue to grow. And it's going to continue to grow disproportionately in Asia, specifically in China. And I think they recognize, given their experience back in the last decade with the Premier Automotive Group, that going head-to-head with the Europeans in Europe is not easy. You have to have a distribution network. You have to have probably standalone dealerships. That's not easy to do with something like a Lincoln. You don't want to have it next door to a Ford store in Cologne, Germany. You want to have it off by itself. That means you've got to have dealers who are willing to take the risk. I think they think that in China, it's a better bet. It's more highly regarded as a theoretical brand, maybe, than it would be in Europe. And they're betting on the longer term. I understand why they're doing that. But if you're not going to play in Europe with your brand, I don't see how you can make a pretension to be a global luxury brand, which gets back to my whole point about their pretensions. They really have not been able to crack the German code. And part of that is because the German automakers have defined the global luxury game. They devise the rules and they enforce the rules. And anybody who doesn't think that ought to go to an auto show overseas and listen to some of the scuttlebutt that goes on.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks so much, Daniel. Always good talking with you.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The days are shorter. The leaves are changing. We're cheering for football teams. It's fall. That means it's time to say hello to Keith Taylor, here with his picks for our fall reading. Keith is a poet and writer who coordinates the undergrad creative writing program at the University of Michigan. Hello, Keith. So where are we starting?
Well, with somebody you've talked to not too long ago, maybe a couple months ago, Bill Morris, with a novel, a crime novel called Motor City Burning.
We had a really interesting conversation with Bill,
and yes, very much so.
And I'm going to pretend we didn't do that now. So if you all listen to that conversation, hit the delete button for a minute, because we want to get Keith's take on Motor City Burning and why you feel it's a good fall pick.
Okay, I will. Well, the title, as some people will realize, comes from that great John Lee Hooker song, "Oh, the Motor City." City's burning, it ain't no thing in the world that I can do. My hometown is burning down to the ground, worser than Vietnam. One of the great blues songs of the last 50 years, covered by lots of bands, particularly lots of Detroit bands. I think it's written, you know, this iconic novel, and a novel written about iconic moments in Detroit's history. The first of all, the riots in 67, and that's where the Hooker song comes from, of course, on that moment that shaped so much of the history of the city, and it's been seen, rightly or wrongly, as the defining moment of race relations in the city. And then a year after that, of course, 1968, the Tigers run to the World Series. Only a year later, it suddenly felt like we were all on the same side, as if we were all brothers in the city.
Yes.
But, of course, like so many of those sports moments, they feel
great
when they happen. It's ephemeral.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
He creates two very interesting characters. You probably talked to him about them, both of whom are really attractive. There's Willie Bledsoe, who's a recent immigrant to Detroit from the South, disillusioned black activist who may or may not be involved in the last unsolved murder that took place during the riots. And then, of course, there's the cop investigating the murder, Frank Doyle. Irish-American, relentless, just, you know, like cops are supposed to be.
Right.
It sounds as if the book would go in only one way. We'd end up with a clear sense of right and wrong. We'd find out who did it, and everything would be resolved.
And it does mix true fact with
this fiction.
Because there was this at last unsolved murder.
Absolutely, yeah. And then everything about the riots is right. But Morris doesn't let us off that easily. I don't want to give too much away, even though we've talked a lot about him here. But it's enough to say that the book is morally complex, more thought-provoking than spine-tingling. But the best thing about it, for those of us who know Detroit, are the descriptions of the city in the late 60s, of buildings and neighborhoods that no longer exist, of the old industrial giant that has been inevitably diminished. There were lots of wonderful descriptive moments that might seem horrible to someone who lives elsewhere, but that we recognize as true and even beautiful. And there's a bunch of them. There's wonderful descriptions about the factories and everything. The one I just picked out this one early on to read it right at the end here. So this is Willie remembering his first winter in Detroit, an experience all of us have had and will have shortly, although maybe I should remind people
let's not go there.
Right. The neighborhood was shabby, glass glittering on the sidewalks, houses in need of paint, black bruises on the street where cars had leaked their vital fluids. In the shadows between houses, there were still gray slag heaps of unmelted snow. In April, surviving his first Detroit winter was not something Willie was going to forget anytime soon. One day, he was sitting in buttery sunshine in Palmer Park, reading the autobiography of Malcolm X, watching swans glide across the pond, marveling at the palette of trees, the bloody reds, the juicy oranges, the richest colors he'd ever seen. The next morning, he awoke to a blizzard, the first of his life. A storm had come howling down out of Canada in the night and dumped a foot of snow on the city.
So true. And as someone who grew up in Ferndale and knew Detroit, and I was in high school when all of that happened, it was like watching – when you watch Mad Men, and if you grew up in that era and the detailing is so exquisite, you go, my word, that look, you know, Sally Draper's bedroom looks like my bedroom when I was seven. There were so many true things. I used to ice skate at Palmer Park.
Oh, did you really? Where the swans were.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, it's great. I mean, he really has a good memory, a sharp memory of the city. Although I don't believe he's lived here for 40 years.
No, not for a long, long time. Yeah. And you don't have to have lived through it to find it a good read.
It's true. It's true. You don't. You don't. But if you want that education of what the city was like in the late 60s, it's good.
All right. So that's Bill Morris, Motor City Burnin'.
All right. So now a very different book by a woman named Roxane Gay. It's a book of essays called Bad Feminist. Might be a little bit of a stretch to call her a Michigan writer because she came to Michigan to do a doctorate in technical writing, but way up at Michigan Tech up in Houghton. There she, by the way, she helped found a literary magazine called Pank, which New York Times said was one of the 15 best places for a young writer to publish in Houghton.
Which is
incredible. She's left now. She finished her degree and she's gone off. And this year she's published both a novel, which has gotten a really nice bit of attention, and this interesting collection of essays, which I like a lot.
All right.
I want to first of all just give you her definition of bad feminism, because I think it's important for understanding the rest of the book. I openly embrace the label of bad feminist. I do so because I am flawed and human. I'm not terribly well-versed in feminist history. I'm not as well-read in key feminist texts as I would like to be. I have certain interests and personality traits and opinions that may not fall in line with mainstream feminism, but I am still a feminist. I cannot tell you how freeing it has been to accept this about myself. So you get a little bit of the tone of what she's doing and how important the idea is to her. It's a feminism that isn't perfect, but that becomes the lens through which she understands our culture and, perhaps most importantly, her place in it. She is smart, funny, angry, confident, yet often winningly self-deprecating. She writes about the rights of women, about the issues that confront a young black intellectual. She writes about sex and film, about the images we've created of girls and the roles we stick people in because of their race or gender orientation. One essay will begin with Vanessa Williams and the Miss American pageant, and the very next one will begin by discussing Judith Butler, who's one of the most intellectually demanding feminist critics out there. Gay will write about 50 Shades of Grey and the Hunger Games, but always she will keep herself in the picture, making it clear that this is one person's engagement with this particular idea. Here's how she describes her first encounter with the Hunger Games. I do most of my leisure reading at the gym. I hate exercise. Yes, it's good for you and weight loss and whatever, but normally I work out and want to die. I knew I was in love with the Hunger Games when I did not want to get off the treadmill. The book captivated me. I wanted to stay in the world Collins created. More than that, the Hunger Games moved me. There was so much at stake, so much drama, and it was all so intriguing, so hypnotizing, so intense and dark. I particularly appreciated what the book got right about strength and endurance, suffering and survival. I found myself gasping and hissing and even bursting into tears more than once. I looked insane, but I did not care. I was completely without shame. So see her doing her thing at the gym,
very relatable,
crying over the Hunger Games.
I think when you, as you say, when she says I'm an imperfect feminist, then virtually so is everybody who's reading her book.
Exactly.
So we can kind of see ourselves in what she's saying. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So that is Roxane Gay's Bad Feminist collection of essays.
Great. Next one is a book, a collection of short stories by Andy Mozina. M-O-Z-I-N-A. It's called Quality Snacks.
I like that name.
It is. It's a great title. And that, of course, has to be the story I read from later on. Like Roxane Gay, it's really wide-ranging. It's a lot of different things going on. It's funny. It's sarcastic. It's satirical. And it's also really smart. It also gets frightening. It gets quite frightening from time to time. Mozina, who teaches, by the way, over in Kalamazoo, at Kalamazoo College, he's put together these stories, they're connected with this sort of general idea of weird things happen at the most common moments. A little bit of the wonderful intersects with our lives in places we don't expect.
This sounds like something good to read Halloween week.
Oh, well, some of this would fit, I think, yeah. Of course, the lives aren't really ours, even when we recognize them. The title story, Quality Snacks, is filled with second-level management types for the Frito-Lay Corporation. Now, I've never met any of these people who work for Frito-Lay, but they seem real. Their concerns seem real. But forgive me, anybody out there who works for Frito-Lay, there's also something really wonderfully silly about them. Here's the opening page of the story. You get a sense, by the way, he does these wonderful first sentences all the way through. So this is the first opening paragraph of the story called Quality Snacks. Assembled there in a fifth-floor conference room at the North American headquarters in Plano were 12 of Frito-Lay's finest minds. No, we weren't the very top of the org chart, though Helen was VP for Consumer Strategy, Insights, and Growth, but we represented a crucial creative force. I believed a company was driven by its products, period. As a senior project scientist for the Doritos platform, I had devoted my entire professional career to creating quality snacks. What's that phrase? Senior project scientist for the Doritos platform. You know, it's
and everybody automotive listening to that could probably go,
exactly.
Yeah, that could be us too.
Yeah.
One of our many meetings,
right? Although you know, Doritos is maybe a little bit different.
Yeah.
than escorts, but and again, those first sentences, he just does first sentences.
Pulls you right in, huh?
Yeah. Every story, they're all different. They're all different lengths. They're funny. You go, whoa! I want to read that. So it's a lot of fun.
So that's Andy Mozina's from Kalamazoo College.
From Kalamazoo College.
His collection of short stories called Quality Snack.
The last one, here's our time for a book of poems. This is by a young poet named Jamal May. The book is called Hum. Jamal May is a member of a group of young poets. I'm not sure they're a school, but, you know, there's certainly a bunch of them, all between 30 and 40, I think, and they all come out of Detroit. And they're creating some of the best poems in the country. They're winning all the big awards. Everybody's paying attention to them. It's great. Their first books are all out now. Some of them are into their second books. They're really, really the focus of so much of this work that's getting attention is Detroit. Some of them have their roots, their professional roots in a lot of the performance venues that popped up around the city in the last, say, quarter century. But others are very tied to that solitary job of sitting there in a room and working alone on the page. They do all seem to know each other, and they support each other. They help keep each other going. They get each other published, even as their lives and careers take them in and out of the city. Jamal may be the best of the lot. His first book, which is this, is called Hum. It was published last year, and that title is, you know, for three little letters, it tells us a lot. It's a word we use when we can't quite remember a song but want to sing it anyway. We hum. It's the noise that is happening beneath everything else we're doing. There's a hum down there. He writes a sestina, which is a really complicated longish form with repeated words, about the Windsor hum, by the way, that some folks keep hearing over there across the river. They blame it on Zug Island.
Yes.
I think the poem is called The Hum for Zug Island. Here's one, a poem to end on, that just feels real Detroit to me. It's filled with images of work and metal, of cars and love. Hum of the machinist's lover. There is zinc under your breastplate. Copper in your throat. I polish your steel to a shimmer before even considering the music. Your tutu, a nickel-plated half-circle with pleats hammered one by one. eyes flicker like flashlights are behind them, because flashlights are behind them, wired to panels triggered by my touch. Place your cold pincer against my fleshy palm. Lean forward on your wheels. In a voice like cotton, hum us a melody from the speaker box I soldered to your belly. It's fine if you're afraid. Tell me where it aches. Tell me where rust encroaches. I know what oxygen does to your surface. How could I not? I am breath and air and air.
How many times have I said around here to the stateside team, I love poems when Keith reads them to me?
All right.
That is wonderful.
Read it yourself. Take that one home and read it yourself.
Yeah. So just to recap, our first choice that Keith Taylor offered was Bill Morris, Motor City Burning, Roxane Gay's Bad Feminist Collection of Essays, Andy Mojina, Quality Snacks Collection of Short Stories. I'm jumping on that one. And Jamal Gay's
Jamal May's Hum. Oh, we've got two rhyming authors.
May's Hum is a collection of poems. His first book, and the one Keith read us, was Hum of the Machinist's Lover. Great choices to get us through fall, which means we send you back with a order for our winter reading. We'll check in sooner than we probably want to.
Yeah.
Poet and writer Keith Taylor coordinates the undergraduate creative writing program at the University of Michigan. As always, it's a pleasure.
Pleasure's all mine, Cynthia. Thank you.
The Write a House program is a pretty creative way to fill up some of Detroit's empty houses and do it with writers, journalists, poets. You take a vacant house, renovate it, and then award it to a writer whose work has been judged worthy. The writer promises to live in the house at least 75% of the time, pay taxes and insurance, and to become part of Detroit's literary scene. Do that for 2 years, and the house is yours. The first winner of a house is poet Casey Rocheteau. She'll be leaving Brooklyn soon to start her new life in her new house north of Hamtramck. Casey Rocheteau is here now. Casey, the contest and your poetry was judged by a panel, including former United States Poet Laureate Billy Collins. He really praised your work. How much does that kind of praise and becoming the first writer to get a house really mean to you?
Well, I mean, I thought alone when the list of finalists came out and there was the quote from Billy Collins, that in and of itself was reward enough, I think. I think a little bit stunned by all of it. Not because I didn't think my work was that good, but I really, looking at the list of finalists, the people who made it to the top 10, and I don't know who else even applied, but looking at that list of finalists, I was like, these people are so accomplished. And I am both a poet and a historian, but I never studied poetry in school. And so there is a very large amount of, I think, validation, and just, I feel honored.
Tell us about the house you'll be moving into. How different from where you've been living in Brooklyn?
Sure. I mean, I now live in Brooklyn. I live in a 4-bedroom apartment that's, you know, a 5-story walk-up with 2 other people and a dog and a cat. So it's pretty crammed in here. I mean, it's lovely, and for Brooklyn, it's actually affordable. While the house that I'm moving into, it's about 900 square feet. It's gorgeous. I love the layout that they've done to the house. I mean, honestly, I love the house, and I'm very, very excited because one of the things about Brooklyn is that, like, it's really hard to find a space that you have a yard of any sort. And so when I actually got to lay eyes on the house, I'm like, oh my gosh, I can garden and grow things, which is really, really exciting to me.
And you get to sit on a porch.
Yeah. Oh, love the porch.
Now, here's a big question. Do you drive?
I don't. And that was the first thing that I thought of, honestly, like right after I hung up the phone when Toby Barlow called me to tell me that, you know, I'd gotten the house. I got off the phone, screamed, and like ran around the house and was like, oh, geez, I'm going to have to learn how to drive and get a car.
So you'll be coming in November and digging in. And we look forward to seeing the kind of work you do and meeting you in person once you come to Detroit.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I look forward to coming into the city again and meeting more people.
Poet Casey Rocheteau should be moving from Brooklyn to Detroit later this fall as the first winner of the Write a House program. And Write a House will begin taking another round of applications early next year. You can get all the details at their website, writeahouse.com. Casey, thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This year marks the 50th birthday of a car that's carved out a big place for itself in American automotive history, the Ford Mustang. Jay Follis is an automotive historian. He's director of marketing at the Gilmore Car Museum in West Michigan, and his look at the history of Mustang is in the current issue of Michigan History Magazine. Welcome, Jay.
It's great to be here, Cindy.
And auto analyst John McElroy is here. John is host of the AutoLine Daily webcast at autoline.tv. Hello, John McElroy.
Hello, Cindy.
Good to have you both here to talk Mustang. Jay, Ford introduced that Mustang in technically 1964 and a half, but take us back, if you will, to before that introduction. What hole in the market was Ford trying to fill?
Well, actually, they're trying to fill several. You have to really go back and look at it and realize they had just got kind of burned with the Edsel. And so Ford really didn't want to take a big leap into anything new. But you had all these young, creative, very persistent engineers, designers, guys from the marketing department that said, you know what, we have a dream car in mind and we want to do something with this. And they're very persistent. And in fact, they started holding kind of dream sessions off-site at the Fairfield Hotel, and so they became known as the Fairfield Committee. The whole idea was they felt with the Edsel that they kind of had missed the mark. It wasn't their product, but they kind of felt that Ford missed the mark, but there was young guys, young adults, young families, young women that would be starting to buy a second car, not necessarily the first car, but their second car. And they did a lot of market research and came back to the executives and said, we've got to look at this a little differently. Let us take a stab at it. And so they were trying to fill several different markets with one car, which is kind of surprising.
But wasn't Ford doing well with the Thunderbird in the kind of fun sports car category?
They definitely were. And what the guys in the Fairfield Committee kind of felt was that they could do even better. And they kind of felt that if they were given just a little bit of leeway, they could do even better with what they had. They wanted to do something that was, it would be a sports car, but something that would really be geared towards a young audience that they knew there's a lot of young people to be getting their license in the next few years. There's a lot of people that now were in a position could buy a second car. And that was an area that Ford really never looked at, as people that would buy a second car and a second car for fun. And so that's where they really started, trying to kind of put on the pressure.
And John McElroy, we always hear the name of Lee Iacocca very, very much entwined with the Mustang. What did Iacocca and Mustang mean to each other?
Well, there's a whole bunch of fathers for the Mustang, because whenever there's a success in the automotive industry, a lot of people claim that they were part of it. And there's no question that Iacocca played a critical role. But I think it's fair to say that the most important role he played was approving the program and making sure that it got fully funded, because it's really an idea that was brought to him. But Iacocca was a young hard charger in the Ford Motor Company. In fact, I believe, if I remember right, he became president of the Ford division at 32 years of age, the youngest that anybody had ever achieved that position with. And, he wanted the cars to reflect this young, exuberant, can-do America that existed in the 1960s.
But he had to go to Henry Ford II, who was still kind of feeling that huge loss, Jay, that you talked about with the Edsel. Did he have to do quite a sales job on the deuce?
Oh, I believe so. In fact, not just with him, but the whole executive committee. Lee Iacocca kind of looked at those guys as being all these old bean counters, guys that didn't look at cars as anything more than just basic transportation. They didn't want gimmicks or anything like that. And I think that you're right, there's so many people that can take credit for any success, but there's a lot of people involved. And I think what Lee Iacocca really did was push the idea, kind of was the guy that was behind the committee to say, you know what, I'll take it and I'll kind of help push this through. And so, he had to do a lot of convincing. And I know the first meeting that he had where he sat down, Henry Ford II actually got up in the middle of the meeting and walked out. And, of course, Lee Iacocca looks at him and thinks, oh, no, we're crushed. What did I do? What did I say? Was he mad? Was he upset about something? And they realized they still had a lot of work ahead of them. The Ford name was on the building, so you had to get him on board before you could get the executive committee to do anything.
I did see a quote somewhere where Iacocca said that Henry Ford II told me if it wasn't a success, it would be my butt, and I'm paraphrasing, and I might be looking for a new job elsewhere. But it paid off, didn't it, John?
It did. In fact, one of the ways that they got Henry Ford II on board was asking him for his input. What should they do with the car? And I know this story from Hal Sperlich, the product planner at Ford at the time, who said that Henry Ford II decided that there really wasn't enough rear seat leg room. And they actually lengthened the car to accommodate that and to incorporate Henry Ford II's ideas. And so the original Mustang was actually going to be a few inches shorter than it turned out to be. And that's how they got Hank the Deuce, as he was nicknamed, on board with the program.
And would we say, is it fair to say, Jay, that this was a watershed moment in American auto history when this Mustang hit the streets?
Well, it definitely caused an epidemic. And part of that was just not just their ambitious goal of getting the car completed and approved and unveiled, but it was partly because they unveiled it at the World's Fair. It was completely something new. You know, usually your cars are introduced in the fall. This was going to be introduced in April, and it was at the World's Fair where they already knew there'd be a lot of people, a lot of buzz. And I think that buzz and all the marketing they did around it really helped create it. And then, of course, it was a good product. It wasn't just a buzz that people looked at and go, oh, wow, that was a failure. It really took off, and I think it became iconic because of that.
So it was a success both in terms of buzz and also dollars and cents, which, of course, kept it alive, correct?
Exactly. And as far as buzz, I don't think there's anything that's compared with it. You know, you can go back in history, and when Henry Ford came out with the Model A, they sold 400,000 sight unseen because of the Model T, you know, before that. This is probably the next thing, probably even bigger than that, because they were seen all over the place. They had major TV network shows the night before it was unveiled. They unveiled it to the press about 4 days beforehand, and they did little things that, you know, back then, that was a time where they're very secretive about new projects coming out. In fact, a lot of times at dealers, they would have paper covering the windows and say, see the brand new Cadillac or whatever they're introducing, see the brand new car, September whatever, and then they would pull the paper away, or they were very secretive. Well, what they did is some things that were probably intentional, like driving a car and parking it down in Detroit so photos could be taken of it, telling all the press 4 days before the unveiling, okay, you've signed out these PR kits, but it's all confidential. Well, who's going to keep that confidential? So they knew darn well they were going to go out and share what they'd seen, and that just helped build this whole hype that was built around the car. Like I said, they had the TV shows advertising it the night before. You could go down the road, you see a billboard saying the new Mustang's coming. Go to an airport and go, hey, look, there's a new Mustang in the airport. So you couldn't miss it.
I do remember the buzz. A friend of mine, classmate of mine, I was in grade school at the time. Her father worked for the Ethel Corporation and had a test one. And I remember when she rolled up to my house with her dad in this great car, and there truly was buzz, especially that first generation hit the road. John, how many times did Ford change the Mustang over the next five decades?
Well, you know, when it first came out, this was back in the days when Detroit still did the annual styling change. And we saw variations on the styling one year right after the other. Probably one of the biggest changes came at the height of the oil crisis in the 1970s, when they essentially moved the Mustang to the same platform as the Ford Pinto and renamed it the Mustang II. And amongst most hardcore Mustang enthusiasts, they don't like that version of the car very well. Ford later built a version of it, if you remember the old Ford Fairmont, which was built on what they called the Fox platform. And really, up until the very latest car that is just about to come out right now, it's been built on that same old platform. This is the first time for 2015 that we've seen a clean sheet design to the Mustang since about 1979, and that's what makes this new one so exciting.
If you've just joined us, we're marking the 50th birthday of the Ford Mustang and looking ahead at the 2015 Mustang coming very, very soon as we speak with auto analyst John McElroy and auto historian Jay Follis, who is, by the way, with the Gilmore Car Museum in West Michigan. Hey, Jay, was there ever a time when Mustang was close to extinction?
You know, I don't know if I would ever say there was a time it was close to extinction. John really hit it well when he said Mustang II, not real well liked by the hardcore Mustang enthusiast. And I think that's just, that really says a lot. But I don't think it's ever close to extinction. Now, the idea, you know, before they ever got it on the drawing board, I think there's a couple times they really, really had to push and go back to the drawing board and say, okay, what are we going to do to make this happen? And I think a lot of it was just by the time they finally got the executive committee behind them, and they could actually feel something was happening, then I think Mustang was there to stay.
Now, the average age of the Mustang drivers is late 40s, and we're hearing that Ford wants to bring younger drivers into the Mustang corner. How do they want to do that? I'll let you start with that, John.
Well, you know, one way to bring younger people back in is come out with a clean sheet car with exciting styling and all the technology that a younger generation wants today, especially when it comes to infotainment. So this thing has all the Bluetooth connectivity, all the touch screens, and all the other things that so many younger people want to see in the car today. It's also offered with a four-cylinder turbocharged engine, which we haven't seen in a while in this car. So it's not only going to deliver really terrific performance, it's going to get better fuel economy than you would have ever expected in a car like this.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned these things for the younger drivers, the connectivity and all that kind of thing. And didn't Ford stumble with the MyFord Touch?
Well, they did. No, you're exactly right. And that's an issue that they're still struggling with. You know, Ford first came out with Sync, and everybody loved it. And then they may have tried to push the technological envelope a little too fast for people's tastes, and there has been a backlash on that. Now, they've done software upgrades and the like, and they've improved it, but it still may not be where everybody would like to see it.
So we'll have to watch that. Jay Follis, this is the first time Ford's offering Mustang in Europe and Asia. What do you think the challenge will be to sell this car to European and Asian drivers who probably don't have the same appreciation for its history that we do here?
Actually, I don't know if it's going to be a big challenge for them, because we see in the museum world, we see a tremendous amount of interest in cars that are American built when you're overseas. There's just that American muscle, that, you know, the pony car, they seem to be very, very fascinated with it. So I think that we may be surprised, and that may do extremely well in those markets, because the classic cars that we see now are doing very, very well over there. And so if they are expecting to see Mustang and see something brand new, I think they're going to be very surprised. And I think it'll be a very pleasant surprise.
Any thoughts, John McElroy?
I think Jay has got it exactly right. The Mustang is known the world over and has been since it first came out. In fact, when Ford announced to its European dealers that it was going to bring the Mustang over to Europe, including versions with the steering wheel on the right-hand side to be able to be sold in England, for example, you could not believe the reaction of the dealers. They gave it a standing ovation. And in fact, to do the introduction, all Ford did was start up the engine offstage, and the dealers went nuts about it. So this is going to be very interesting to see how it sells overseas. I don't necessarily think it's going to sell in big numbers, but as a halo car, that is something that really puts the shine on the Ford brand. Ford could not have done anything better than offer the Mustang worldwide.
Well, here we are talking about Mustang 50 years after it was introduced. I'd like to wrap with the thoughts of both of you. Why do you think Mustang has endured, Jay?
Well, I think it came out at the right time, and they, for the most part, have stayed with those original themes, original styling, and the original idea behind it. I think what happens is when a car sways too far, you know, it may have come out as a great little sports car or whatever, and they sway too far. With the Mustang, too, I think they really saw it on the wall. They got their message clear that we got to go back to what it was. And I think when cars have done that, they've stayed very loyal to that. They've got a loyal audience. And I think that's why it's iconic today, because it has stayed so true to that for the most part.
John McElroy?
Cindy, I think it's all about the way the car looks and what it represents. You don't look at that car and go, hey, what's that? You look at that car and you say, that's the Mustang. And just the name Mustang, you know, it's a wild horse. And people like to have their cars, or at least the people who are buying Mustangs, reflect what their personality is. Young, vivacious, outdoorsy, you know, wanting to get out and go and do things. And I think that's why this car has lasted so long. People just resonate with what it stands for.
Auto analyst John McElroy hosts the AutoLine daily webcast at autoline.tv. And Jay Follis is an automotive historian who's with the Gilmore Car Museum in West Michigan. You can find his look at the history of the Mustang in the current issue of Michigan History Magazine. You both make me want to go find a Mustang right now and hit the highway and enjoy Michigan fall driving with that Mustang. Great look back, and thanks very much to both of you for joining us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
If there's ever been a little girl in your life at any point, chances are pretty good that Raggedy Ann made her way into your home. The cloth doll with the yarn hair and the button eyes and the candy cane striped stockings has been part of America's toy scene for a century. And as it turns out, Raggedy Ann has some very strong roots in West Michigan. Ann Dake is a curator at the Muskegon Heritage Museum. Ann, tell us, how did Raggedy Ann get those West Michigan roots?
The Raggedy Ann dolls were actually patented by Johnny Gruwell in 1915 in Chicago. And the publishing company who wanted to print the stories in 1918 contacted with the Non-Breakable Toy Company in Muskegon to make the first Raggedy Ann dolls. So the first of them were made right here in Muskegon. And the first 2 years, they made over 13,000 dolls, all by hand. They're all a little different. They're all a little unique. And actually, they continued making them until 1926 and made well over, well, almost 90,000 dolls here in Muskegon.
That's a huge, huge number. Where did Johnny Gruwell get the idea for Raggedy Ann?
Well, the story is that he was an illustrator and a cartoonist, and his daughter, Marcella, found a rag doll in the attic at her grandmother's house. It had been her grandmother's doll, and apparently it was an aunt's or something, too. And so they painted a new face on it, and Johnny Gruwell's creative mind started creating stories about the doll, and they named it Raggedy Ann.
And, you know, it's interesting when you talk about things we love, we don't usually use a term like raggedy because it's not generally a compliment. Why do you think the name has worked so well and that it's stuck for nearly a century?
You know, I don't really know. It probably came from the fact that they were rag dolls. And somehow there were other things previous to that that had some kind of a raggedy type in their name, but apparently Marcella, Johnny's daughter, that's what they named the doll. It was Raggedy Ann. And why Ann, I don't know that either, but the name certainly has stuck, and part of it is simply her iconic smile, her joy. Every time you see one, you can't help but smile and be happy.
Ann Dake is with the Muskegon Heritage Museum, and it was a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Michelle Hahn, Haley Hirschman, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.